Hello, on this week's program, David Patrick Stearns profiles soprano Michelle Johnson. The Metropolitan Opera 2011 National Council audition winner sings Donna Anna in the Academy of Vocal Arts new production of Mozart's Don Giovanni. Eric Brannan considers a Philadelphia public art exhibition viewable only through the screens of smartphones. Susan Lewis takes us to the Penn Museum's exhibition about generations of Pennsylvanians who kept their Lenape identity secret for two centuries. And we speak with Michael Taylor, curator of a Philadelphia Museum of Art exhibition devoted to the works of Marc Chagall and his early 20th century contemporaries in Paris. That's all I have this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
Since the heydays of Leontine Price and Jesse Norman, opera lovers have had to content themselves with beautiful but less luxurious voices. Until now, that is. From the Houston suburbs and via the New England Conservatory of Music, Michelle Johnson is the latest voice to bring glory to Philadelphia's Academy of Vocal Arts, having won the Metropolitan Opera's 2011 National Council auditions last month, an honour that could easily make her career. During a break in rehearsals for AVA's production of Don Giovanni, in which she opens tonight in the role of Donna Anna, she told the Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns how fully aware she is of the world she's about to enter.
When the Metropolitan Opera called to notify the Philadelphia Press that one of its local singers had made the finals in its National Council auditions, and that person's name was Michelle Johnson, well, her victory wasn't in doubt, at least for those who had heard her best performances in these parts. In fact, the Met might as well have handed her the $15,000 prize and not bothered with all that drama and formality. To judge from New York reports of the audience's reaction to Johnson, she has the kind of big, dusky, Italianate voice and a certain controlled wildness that the Met has been waiting for. Inside her own head, the scenario was a bit different.
Well, even just to make it to the semifinals, I think it was like my third try to get past the regionals. And I still feel the palpitations and the hair on the back of my neck stand up when I think about it, because so few singers get to that point. When they said my name, that I went on to the finals, I was like, whoa. All right, game is on now. You know, I didn't come this far to not win. And so that week, I was so focused. You know, I'm a night owl. Most singers are night owls. But that week, I was in bed by 10.
Part of the prize was singing on the Met stage in front of many movers and shakers in the opera world. But Johnson doesn't have a history of shrinking from challenges. Just the opposite, in fact.
It gives me fire. You know, some people are fantastic in rehearsals or in the practice room. I strive to continue to grow and grow in the practice room and in rehearsal. But when it's time to perform, I get this crazy energy and it's on. It was like I was meant to be there. When you feel like it's right, it felt right. And when I hit the last note in the Chilea, and it was like the most free it's ever been. And I was like, oh my God, finally I found the spot. The spot.
Stars aren't born every day. But close to it, though among singers, they have an extraordinarily high fatality rate. The fact that Johnson doesn't yet have management and hasn't sung in many of the operatic capitals that some of the AVA singers are off to even before graduation is a comfort to many who know that the wrong kind of opportunities can kill a voice's future.
I do think about that. It is very, it's not, I'm not going to say it's very easy, but it's easier to get to a point than to stay at a point. So I think about that quite often. I mean, you hear somebody like, oh my gosh, they're great. And then 2 years, you don't hear anything from them. And I don't want to be a one-hit wonder.
Many such singers pass through her native Houston, where the excellent Houston Grand Opera attracts a lot of young artists, but doesn't always catch them in time to stop those with incomplete training from running out of gas. Johnson wasn't really part of that world growing up. She saw Madama Butterfly on TV at age 8, sang in church since her father was a minister, and arrived at Boston's New England Conservatory without a single opera role to her name. She caught up quickly, and upon seeing a video of her first opera role, Miss Jessel in Turn of the Screw, experienced a disconnect between who she thought she was and what she saw on the screen.
I think I was either a junior or a senior, and I remember going back and looking at the video, and I couldn't believe it. No, literally, I couldn't believe it was me. Like they say, you really can't hear yourself when you're singing. I couldn't believe it was me. I couldn't believe that I could make a sound like that.
The rest would have unfolded like a fairy tale, were it not for one significant problem. Michelle Johnson still had the wrong voice. She believed herself to be a mezzo-soprano. Her voice teacher was convinced that she was a lyric soprano. Still, Johnson didn't want to switch.
And there's like a million lyric voice sopranos out there. I guess I was trying to go the easy way out. I was like, well, it's not that many mezzos, so I'll just stick in mezzo land. But, you know, you kind of have to follow the voice, and wherever the voice goes, you have to go with it.
The opera profession doesn't require singers to be mature adults, but given all that can go wrong in any given production, it certainly helps even inside the protective walls of the Academy of Vocal Arts. The current Don Giovanni was hotly anticipated partly because of the collaboration between a theatrical animal like Johnson and the veteran director Tito Capobianco. However, Capobianco was only able to finish the first act. His wife Gigi died during rehearsals. Justin Johnson stepped in to complete what was left undone in one of the more intricate ensemble operas ever written. Everyone needs to agree, he says, on how to chase down the notorious Don Giovanni in the seduction rampage that is his life.
Before you can move on, you have to have a resolution. Someone has to either relent or you have to have a meeting of the minds, because otherwise that can really put the brakes on the development of the show and the characters.
Most of our pieces in the show, we are ganging up on one person. So we have to agree at some point. And if one person, if I don't agree with one of the something in the staging, I would just look so odd.
Right. Everybody has to buy into a vision.
If that is indeed what happened in the weeks leading up to opening night, well, they're blessed. The opera world is notorious for productions in which opening night arrives with the singers not speaking to the conductor, vice versa, or to each other. Much of having a career means working under impossible circumstances without the audience ever catching on. Maybe that's the one indispensable requirement for operatic stardom. Some great talents simply don't have the stomach for it. But maybe, just maybe, Michelle Johnson does.
Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Academy of Vocal Arts production of Mozart's Don Giovanni opens this evening at the Academy of Vocal Arts and runs in 6 performances at 4 other venues in the Philadelphia region through May 15th. Sitting atop the steps of the Philadelphia Museum of Art is a massive new sculpture. However, this, as well as many other new public artworks dotted around the city, are easy to miss if you don't know where or especially how to look for them. Now WRTI's Eric Brown considers a new project by 2 groups working to create virtual works of art that exist in real places.
Right now, a giant squid is hovering above the Schuylkill at the Fairmount Waterworks. An alien with a Juan Miró painting for skin is standing frozen at the top of the steps at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Though invisible to the naked eye, these sculptures do exist, but only in a sort of new technology ether, and only accessible by a smartphone.
We place 3D computer models, sculptures, at site-specific locations.
Chris Manzione is the founder and director of the Virtual Public Art Project.
And users can go to these locations with their smartphone and view the models in the round.
Teaming up with Breadboard, an art and technology advocate working out of the University City Science Center, the groups have placed 34 virtual sculptures by 23 artists in various locations around the city. The technology being used to make these works visible is called augmented reality. Though it may not sound familiar, Manzione says it's been used on television for years.
If you're watching a football game and there's digital lines that go across the field and say like what down it is or how many more yards they have to go, that's augmented reality. So it's a live view through a camera with digital information on top of it.
Meaning that contextual information ranging from text to three-dimensional graphics like those in the Virtual Public Art Project can be superimposed over a live image that, in this case, is produced and viewed on a smartphone, specifically certain Apple iPhones or devices running Google's Android operating system. The applications of this technology are broad, ranging from video games that use a player's location as its setting to sightseeing guides that display information relevant to where the viewer's standing. Manzione, who is also a sculptor of real objects, says that augmented reality enables him to do things as an artist not possible in the real world.
Logistically, I can have shows all around the world. I can make sculptures that are 1,000 feet tall. I can make them float. They can have animated texture on them. So, like, building things beyond physics.
Using GPS, artists are able to put virtual objects in places they've personally never even been. Breadboard director Dan Schimmel says that this gives artists the chance to create site-specific works which would otherwise be off-limits.
Some of the most interesting projects that artists are doing are using augmented reality to comment on physical spaces and physical realities. So they've put some augmented reality sculptures around very politically charged locations, say the border between Mexico and the U.S., Chernobyl. Somebody could put something over Guantanamo, which is a restricted area. So it gives artists a lot of potential if their art is commenting on social issues or events that happen around the world.
Though there are no politically charged works in the current Virtual Public Art Project show, the sculptures were placed in relevant locations.
Some of the works are more site-specific and interact with the space. For instance, we have one of those eight-ball cubes that is next to Rodin's Thinker.
The site-specific nature of augmented reality is part of the appeal for Chris Manzione.
Otherwise, you know, you can email anything. I could email you that sculpture. That's easy. But requiring someone to walk out or go into the middle of Philadelphia and like move around.
However, like any technology in its infancy, augmented reality is not without its problems. The processing power of smartphones has only recently developed enough to achieve anything close to the desired effect of the Virtual Public Art Project. But the technology can still be limiting.
Conceptually, there's much more interesting things that can be done, or that will be able to be done. Right now, we're limited to model size, and how complex that model is, and also everything's fairly static.
There are also questions about whether or not this public art project can truly be considered public.
Obviously, there's a big digital divide, and there's a lot of people who don't have access to the technology, so they can't even see the work.
Chris Manzione agrees, but is optimistic.
Right now, yeah, it excludes a very large portion of the public. And, you know, it is the Virtual Public Art Project, and it operates within a small group of people who have the devices to go see it. But, you know, I think same as the internet, it's going to be something that's on every phone, like a camera or a touchscreen. I think it'll be something very easily accessed, if not thrown in front of your face.
However, today it is still a frontier medium, which can be both rewarding and challenging.
I think it's exciting. I think a lot of things are being figured out, and it's even at times hard to be considered in an art context sometimes. It's sort of dismissed as not a fine art or not art at all. It's just this like techie thing that we're like goofing around with, but I don't feel that way.
Though the validity of computer-generated sculpture as art is still up for debate, It's important to remember that when technological advances like photography and motion pictures were first presented as art, they were greeted at best with skepticism and at worst with disdain. Despite its technical limitations and relative exclusivity, the implications of the Virtual Public Art Project are impressive. Art that can be as large and complex as an artist's mind allows, rather than what they can afford or are permitted by the physical limitations of our world.
WRTI's Eric Brannan. For information on how to view the sculptures in the Virtual Public Art Project, follow the link at wrti.org.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
According to conventional history, few, if any, Lenape Indians remained in Pennsylvania after the 18th century, most having been killed or driven west by European settlers. However, an exhibition at the University of Pennsylvania Museum tells the story of those who stayed, forming communities whose members hid their Lenape identities, yet managed to continue and pass on their traditions in secret for nearly two centuries. Now WRTI's Susan Lewis takes us to Fulfilling a Prophecy, the Past and the Present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania.
When University of Pennsylvania anthropology student Abigail Selden was putting together a one-case exhibit about what happened to the Lenape people, she met with the elders of today's Lenape Nation of Pennsylvania and asked them why there was virtually nothing about them in the literature.
Every book I've read says that you don't exist and that you're not in Pennsylvania anymore. And they said, yeah, we know. I said, but you're here. And they said, well, we've been keeping our history a secret for 200 years, so of course it's not in the books.
The Lenape's cautious willingness to share their history was a doorway, opened a crack, into another culture, a natural fit with a museum dedicated to understanding the world's cultural heritage, let alone one in its own backyard. Selden's advisor, anthropology professor Robert Prussell, curator of the American section at the Penn Museum, says that while most of the cultures in the museum are presented at a point in the past...
For example, ancient Egypt, we have incredible collections here, but there's not a lot on contemporary Egypt here. So one of the things that we want to do with Native America is to show the continuities and connections between the archaeology, the history, and the contemporary communities.
So what started out as a small student project grew into a museum show covering hundreds of years. Co-curated by Selden, along with Chief Bob Red Hawk Ruth, and Shelley DePaul of the Lenape Nation, it took its shape and context from a story handed down through the generations called Prophecy of the Fourth Crow, about, among other things, hiding and returning.
Long ago it was said that a fox will be loosened on the earth. Also, it was said four crows will come.
As the story goes, the first crow flew in harmony with the Creator. The second crow tried to clean the world, but he became sick and died. The third crow saw his dead brother, and he hid. The fourth crow flew the way of harmony again with the Creator. The ending comes full circle.
Caretakers, they will live together on the earth.
As told here, the first crow in the prophecy corresponds to the Lenape before the first contact with Europeans. The second crow represents the period from about 1600 until 1800, when initially peaceful coexistence with William Penn and others deteriorated in subsequent generations. This is starkly illustrated by an enlarged 1764 ad placed by one of William Penn's sons in Benjamin Franklin's Pennsylvania Gazette.
John Penn is offering payment to civilians who capture Delaware or Lenape individuals or who kill them and turn in their scalps as evidence. And the payment for a male over 10 years of age was $134, and for a female, $50. So there was a really clear heritage in Pennsylvania of indiscriminate violence against people of Native American heritage.
By the beginning of the 19th century, remaining Lenape had either fled or gone into hiding, and it is the next 200 years of secrecy, represented by the third crow, that is the driving force of this exhibition. Chief Bob Redhawk says his people found ways to survive.
Whether it was intermarriage, whether it was hiding who you are, you did whatever you could. If you could pass as a white or even as African-American, and this is even during segregation times, we were low men on the totem pole.
Passing as members of other ethnic groups was in some cases made easier because intermarriage was common. Selden says Lenape women, for example, married German farmers and kept connections to their land. Generations of intermarriage eventually created a population with looks as diverse as the larger culture. Children could be blonde and fair-skinned, dark with black hair, and everything in between. Outwardly, they assumed a non-Lenape identity. In the privacy of family gatherings, they continued to practice Lenape traditions and pass down stories. Even outward appearances were full of symbols, as shown in this exhibition on things as ordinary as a kitchen apron with a particular stitch along the bottom, or a wooden fence post with a subtle carving.
Poles like this one were scattered throughout farmland. This has a face on it pretty clearly, but it could just be a signpost.
And what is the face?
It represents Mising, who's the protector of the woodlands.
The importance of secrecy was drummed into the youngest of children, as evidenced by a rag doll in this show.
If you look carefully underneath her hair, which is now pulled to both sides, you can see that there's a second face. And this was a doll that was made for a little girl by her Lenape grandmother in the 1940s. And the woman told the little girl that this doll had the second face and that this represented the little girl's Lenape face and her identity, which she had to keep a secret because she could not tell anybody who she was.
Secrecy, rooted in fear, became part of the culture. But now, perhaps it is indeed the time of the fourth crow. In recent years, more people have begun to openly acknowledge their Lenape heritage, particularly as caretakers of nature. In 2002, the Lenape Nation signed the first Treaty of Brotherhood, with churches and other community groups pledging to support the Lenape cultural education programs and their work for the environment. The chief himself has traveled openly internationally, on tour with his large drum, which for now sits in a gallery at the Penn Museum, along with artifacts and photographs, evidence of children and parents, grandparents, and great-grandparents.
These people were living, breathing people, and it's because of their ways of surviving that we're here today, and we're hoping that our children can come in here now and be proud.
It is their story, and it is our story. A rich texture in the national fabric, an important part of what it means to be an American, native or not.
That report was by WRTI's Susan Lewis. Fulfilling a prophecy, the past and present of the Lenape in Pennsylvania is at the University of Pennsylvania Museum through July 11th. Marc Chagall was one of the most successful artists of the 20th century. Born in 1887, he grew up in a Russian Jewish ghetto during a time of rank anti-Semitism. In his late teens, he moved to St. Petersburg, where he studied art and was introduced to the worlds of experimental theatre and the Ballet Russe. In 1910, he emigrated to Paris, where he joined a host of other artists, many also Eastern European exiles, living at La Ruche, an artist community nicknamed the Beehive because of its honeycomb-like maze of studios. Chagall developed a distinctive style combining cubism with traditions from his Russian homeland. Prompted by the first Philadelphia International Festival of the Arts and its focus on Paris between 1910 and 1920, an exhibition currently on view at the Philadelphia Museum of Art makes the case that Chagall's artistry is more complex than previously realized, and that his work in Paris was greatly informed by his homeland and his experiences in the City of Light. Michael Taylor is curator of Paris Through the Window, Marc Chagall and His Circle.
I felt that Chagall was actually ripe for reinterpretation. I feel like he's an artist who at the end of his life told a great story, which is that he came out of nowhere almost fully formed as an artist and self-taught and went on to this glittering career. And what this show, I think, demonstrates for the first time is that he came from somewhere, and that somewhere was Vitebsk in Russia. He trained in Russia with people like Nicholas Roerich and Leon Bakst. And then he ends up in Paris and trains again with people like Metzinger and Delaunay. So he was not fully formed. He actually did have an extensive training, and it had a great impact on his work. Doesn't mean he's not a unique artist. He surely is. But I think this show makes him a more interesting, a more complex artist than we maybe thought of before.
He never loses that Russianness, though.
No, and in fact, we really wanted to bring that out. We added a Ballet Russe section, because his early training is in the theatre, and we wanted to bring that out. That's why he loves colour and movement. There is a sort of lovely lightness of his work. He's also a great storyteller, and I think that's part of his upbringing. And when you start to sort of think in these ways, you really realize what he brought to the game, because he does it better than anyone. I think he surpasses his teachers and becomes iconic, really, as one of the great colorists of the 20th century, rivaling Matisse, but also one of the great storytellers. And for that, I think he has no equal.
Speaking of storytelling, your curatorial style is, the aesthetic is obviously important, but so too is the narrative. What's the story you're trying to tell here?
Well, it's true what you say, because I believe that all great exhibitions do tell a story, and the story has to be compelling. And so this story works on many levels. It's about immigration, what can happen to someone who arrives in a city like Paris in May 1911 and reinvents themselves as a modern artist. It's also about exile, because, of course, this man lived through the First World War and the Second World War and was displaced. And it's also a story about struggle. You know, the artist of La Ruche, we sort of did a recreation of that community. And La Ruche means beehive, and it was a studio complex in Paris where it was affordable, and these artists lived one on top of the other. Many of them came out famous, and many of them we've never heard of again.
Most of them are Eastern European and very poor when they arrived.
Yeah.
This was the promised land, after all, at the start of the 20th century.
It really was. And the Eastern European artists tended to be the poorest, and they had no visible means of support. So La Ruche was a kind of communal center in the southern fringes of Montparnasse, so very far out from the center of Paris. But what it gave them was a shared identity, and you did have these larger-than-life figures like Jules Pascin, and Modigliani would be the most famous. But Chagall is right in the middle of that. And as I said to you before, he came from somewhere. He didn't really live the life that he claimed he did. When he spoke about La Ruche, he said, I locked my door, I never went out. Of course we know that's not true. He was designing the theater there. He was very much involved with the lives of the other artists, which included such towering figures as Fernand Léger, Alexander Arkhipenko, all of these sort of great artists who come out of La Ruche and in the 20s do become the school of Paris. And Chagall's really at the forefront of that international movement.
Before you set out to curate this exhibition, what had your interactions been with Chagall academically or even in the museum world? And how did your view of him change as you proceeded with putting this exhibition together?
Well, it's interesting. I'm drawn to the artists who are a little forbidden. And in terms of mainstream modernism, Chagall is considered a very sweet, sentimental artist, maybe not on the level of, say, a Malevich. He's kind of bracketed out, and I think his popularity has sort of been the death of him. He's sort of associated with other figures that I've enjoyed looking at, like Salvador Dali, people who did reach this wider audience. And so part of me is attracted to the phenomenon of that, because I'm a great believer that you don't reach a wide audience without having some great talent. And in the case of Chagall, what the show does is it reveals really where he was coming from and what world he belonged to. And it was a fascinating moment in the visual arts where you do have the legacy of Cubism, and that's really what the first gallery is about. That gives him the tools to be a modern artist. But from there, he's able to infuse it with those folk traditions. And that's why he can speak to a wide audience, because he's tapping into a kind of universal aesthetic, which is, you know, he believes that the background that he had, the upbringing he had, the Jewish beliefs and customs and rituals make him unique. That's his story, and he wants to tell it to the world. And he does so very effectively.
Michael Taylor, curator of modern art at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Paris Through the Window, Marc Chagall and His Circle, runs through July 10th. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnov. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.